It's KUOW's The Record. Welcome to it. I'm Bill Radke. We're live tweeting the show at KUOW. A robot can now call up and make a hair salon appointment, and the hair salon manager doesn't apparently know that the robot does not have hair. We'll talk about where all this is going. Is it creepy? Is it convenient? What could go wrong? Stay tuned for that. But first, our top stories. You may have just heard the city of Seattle is considering a new compromise head tax. This is the proposed tax on every employee of Seattle's top grossing businesses. It's been very controversial. The city council favored one version. Amazon didn't like that, said they might slow their growth in Seattle in response. The mayor proposed a smaller tax. That didn't fly. This morning, a city council member proposed a new compromise, and Crosscut reporter David Croman was there at City Hall, and now he's here in our studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
What's the new plan?
The new plan, it would charge employers that have revenues of $20 million or higher, it would charge them $275 per employee per year. That's down from the original proposal of $500 per employee per year. The council members believe that this new proposal would raise about $50 million per year for housing construction and homeless services.
Okay, so that was a lot of numbers, but one number is instead of $75 million raised from these businesses, now it's an estimated $50 million a year.
Yes.
Gives you some sense of the scale of reduction.
Yes.
And it would expire after 5 years unless renewed?
Yeah, so we haven't actually seen this proposal written down. We're just kind of hearing this from Councilmember Lorena Gonzalez. But speaking after the meeting this morning, she said, yeah, in 2023, the city, whichever city council members were there at the time, would have to vote to renew that tax.
Okay, so a smaller employee head tax, employee hours tax, subject to renewal, and this compromise appeals to whom and why?
It appeals to, well, we're not entirely sure who it appeals to yet because it's so new, so they haven't actually—
The vote is coming up this afternoon,
yeah, it will happen at 2 o'clock, so we don't know exactly how it will shake out. Councilmember Gonzalez said she believed they had a majority of council members, but they're not sure if they have a veto-proof majority, which is a big question mark. But on its surface, it looks like it appeals to a sort of constituent or sort of block of politicians inside City Hall that were really skeptical from the get-go of any head tax. But there seems to be some acknowledgement that something is going to pass one way or the other. So that brought them to the table to try and negotiate something that they felt was smaller and a little more manageable. So this would be the mayor, Jenny Durkin, council members like maybe Sally Bagshaw, the kind of more, quote, business-friendly coalition of people in City Hall.
There are 9 city council members. This tax would need 5 yes votes to pass, but as you suggested, 6 yes votes to be veto-proof. Mm-hmm. What has Mayor Durkin reacted to this compromise at all? It's a little more of a tax than she had proposed.
Right. So we know that Councilmember Gonzalez in sort of cobbling together this proposal has been meeting with the mayor over the weekend and with her staff. In a statement this morning, the mayor said that she appreciated that effort. She did not say, though, whether she would sign or even approve of the final version. We also know that Councilmember Shama Sawant, who really favors the largest possible tax, is unlikely to get behind this. So that means we know 4 council members that are probably going to vote for it. Who that 5th person is or who that 6th person is, I'm not entirely sure yet.
What about Amazon? What have they said, if anything?
They haven't said anything yet. I mean, I think that's probably because we've literally just learned about this in the last couple hours.
It was Amazon's opposition that most famously worked against this idea of a tax, although the Chamber of Commerce is against it, a whole list of businesses, right? Starbucks, Alaska Airlines.
Yeah, and I don't think that has changed at all. Even when the mayor proposed her compromise last week, the chamber was still not in favor of that. They're never going to be in favor of a head tax. I doubt Amazon is going to ever actually favor one. The question is whether or not they would withdraw these threats that they've made to stop construction as a result.
Yeah, that's one. We're talking with Crosscut reporter David Croman. That was one opposition that Amazon's and other businesses would be hurt, don't deserve to pay it, might slow down, all that, those possibilities. Another objection has been from people who say the city has not demonstrated it can or will spend this money wisely. So what would, under this compromise, smaller version of the head tax, Bill, what would the money be spent on?
I think that, we talk a lot about the size of the measure, but I think actually what the biggest debate right now in City Hall is about is how that money would be spent.
Yeah.
So the mayor really proposed, she proposed spending most of that money on kind of more emergency, emergency responses to homelessness. So this is shelter beds, more outreach, things like that, that would sort of get people off the streets more quickly. But the council members who proposed the measure to begin with, they are really focused on building more permanent affordable housing. And at this point, as far as I can tell, where the strongest disagreement will be is over how that money kind of breaks down.
Yes. Why? Can you remind us basically why is there a divide on where this proposed money should go?
So the council members who are favoring building more affordable housing, they point to a few different studies and audits that have come out recently, one from King County, one from this consulting firm, that basically say, you know, one of the biggest problems the county and the city are dealing with right now is the shelters are full and people are not leaving the shelters. And the reason that people are not leaving the shelters is because there's no homes for them to move into. And so therefore, the response is we should be building more homes. You know, on the flip side from the mayor and some of her allies on the city council, I think that they are under a lot of pressure from the people who voted them into office to do something really quickly to make the problem on the streets less bad. And that response would be things like, as I mentioned before, adding more shelter beds, doing more garbage cleanup, and things like that.
Do you know how full Seattle's shelters are? Because I've also heard the argument that there are beds, but that some people who could use the beds don't want to go to a shelter.
Yeah, I mean, I think from what I've seen, the any accounts that the beds are not full somehow tend to be more anecdotal, whereas if you actually sort of look at more kind of comprehensive surveys of the shelters, they by all appearances are very, very full right now. It is true that there are a lot of people who do not want to go into shelter, and that's not because they enjoy being on the streets. It's that a lot of the shelter options in Seattle are pretty restrictive. So, you know, they're only open from 7 p.m. at night to 5 a.m. in the morning, or you can't bring your possessions in, or you can't come in with your partner or your pets. So that is something that the city's trying to deal with, is to open up more kind of comprehensive shelters to fix that problem. But yeah, I mean, that's an issue for sure, that for some people it's easier to live in a tent where they can stay than it is to cycle in and out of these shelters.
So this latest compromise head tax proposal, estimated $50 million a year instead of the original $75 we heard about. If that were to pass this afternoon, but without a spending plan, I can't imagine critics of the city saying, oh, so you just approved taking money without promising, without saying here's how it's going to be spent. Is that going to be a potent objection? And is that an unusual way for the city to operate?
I don't think you're the only person who can imagine that happening. I think the city council knows that that would happen. And so in response to that, Councilmember Gonzalez said she will not pass a head tax without a spending plan. So they don't technically need to do this. They could pass the tax and then kind of figure it out later. But I think they're really cognizant of the fact that a lot of Seattle is really skeptical about how the city spends its money. So they feel like if they're going to pass this large of a tax, they need to be able to point to something and say, this is how it's going to be spent.
So then how can there be a vote this afternoon at 2 o'clock on the tax plan without an agreement? We just talked about the divide over the spending plan.
I think they're still debating that in real time, and we'll be debating that from city chamber, council chambers today at 2 p.m.
That could all come together in less than 2 hours?
We've seen, you know, they had the weekend too to kind of debate this, but it wouldn't be the first time we've seen spending plans come together in that short of a period of time.
Okay, again, city council votes today, and what bottom line, Crosscut reporter David Croman, what do you, based on what you know, what do you think is going to happen today?
I wish I could give you a solid answer. I mean, I think it could be anything from, I think we can be fairly sure that Councilmember Sawant would vote against whatever is going to end up on the table today. So there's one no vote.
She wants a larger tax.
She wants a larger tax. She wants what passed out of the committee last week. I don't think that is going to happen. So then for me, it's a question of whether or not this is an 8-1 vote, meaning that this has managed to convince enough council members that this is a good enough plan that everybody will vote for it, or whether it ends up being something closer to 6-3 with Sawant kind of siding with some of the people who were skeptical of it from the start, or it could end up passing 5-4 and we're kind of back to where we were with the threat of a mayoral veto.
Okay, a possible compromise on what now the latest is, it would be a $275 per employee per year tax, mm-hmm. down from $500. And would it still revert, change to a payroll tax in a couple of years?
No, it would not. So before it was, it was going to shift from per employee tax to kind of a tax on total payroll. There was some confusion around which method businesses actually preferred.
Right.
At first, they seem to think that businesses preferred the payroll tax, but that might not actually be true. So I think for simplicity's sake, they just eliminated that.
Okay. I reckon you'd like to go back to City Hall?
Yeah, I will be there when we're done here.
Okay. Crosscut, we're done. Crosscut reporter David Croman, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW. We'll follow this right along with you and let you know the details as we find out. We're going to talk about human fooling robots and what happened over the weekend. So stay tuned. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. I'm human. I'm not a robot, so I say. But how would you know? Last week, Google showed off an artificially intelligent robot making a haircut appointment. Unless this tape was misleadingly edited, the hair salon employee does not appear to know she's talking to a robot.
Hello, how can I help you?
Hi, I'm calling to book a women's haircut for a client. I'm looking for something on May 3rd.
Sure, give me 1 second.
And then the robot says, mm-hmm, while it's waiting. And it's more than that. They've got a back and forth that goes on for almost a minute.
We have a 10 o'clock.
10 a.m. is fine.
Okay, what's her first name?
The first name is Lisa.
And it goes on to a successful appointment made. And robots can do this, apparently. Does that sound convenient? Does that sound creepy? Does that sound both? And what could go wrong? My guests now are Dr. Oren Etzioni, CEO of the Allen Institute for Artificial Intelligence here in Seattle. Welcome back.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
And the co-founder of the tech news website GeekWire, Todd Bishop. Welcome back, Todd.
Thanks, Bill.
Oren, you reacted to the Google haircut bot by calling for mandatory disclosure. Any artificial intelligence content must be labeled so. What's an example of how that labeling would happen?
It's very simple. Whenever we have a bot like that, before it starts the conversation, it says, hey, I'm an AI or I'm an artificial intelligence system.
If that's okay with you, press 1.
Right? If not, press 2.
Yeah. Okay. Won't AI play some role in almost everything? Eventually, it's one thing, a telephone call is one thing, but every movie that Netflix suggests, everything Alexa says, every ad you see, you know, how would labeling keep up with artificial intelligence?
That's a great question. So AI really is becoming ubiquitous, and I'm not saying that we should label every single use of it, but when AI is impersonating someone, so it's pretending to be a person and you can't tell, or you might not be able to tell. That's number one. Or when AI is creating content like an image or a video that you might think is real, right? Fake news is the big term. In those situations, it's essential to disclose that this is AI in action.
Creating content or pretending. We could get into definitions of those. But what's your reaction over at GeekWire, Todd?
I, first of all, was really impressed with the technical accomplishment here. And this is something that Oren talks about quite a bit. This is not general artificial intelligence. In other words, that agent that was speaking to the person on the phone, the AI agent, could not have gone off and coached our kids' soccer teams with that level of intelligence. This was a very dedicated, specific bot. That said, this is a holy grail in terms of AI, the ability to convince somebody on the other end of the line. It's the Turing test.
Why is that the holy grail?
Well, because the whole idea is for AI to ultimately reach the level of human intelligence. And in this one limited specific domain, it was really impressive. I'd be curious to hear what you thought, if this surprised you or if this was sort of something you expected at this point of AI's evolution.
So the scientific background is, in the 50s, Alan Turing said, how would we be able to tell when software, when a computer has achieved intelligence? And he proposed a test that was purely external, right? You don't look inside the machine's head, but you simply say, can you pass a test where I can't distinguish you as an AI program from a person? And that's become known as the Turing test, 60 years, the ultimate test of intelligence. More recently, John Markoff, famous AI reporter, said, well, the Turing test is really a test of human gullibility.
Right.
It's a test to what extent are we able to trick people. But in the annals of human gullibility, we've just crossed, as Todd says, we crossed a threshold. We now have this ability to trick people that we haven't had before. I think of it as a canary in the coal mine, right? We all have differing ideas, including our conversation a while ago on this show, about how long until we achieve general intelligence, super intelligence, all kinds of ambitious scenarios like that. But what we clearly have today is the ability to book appointments, to have these targeted conversations automatically.
What are some other examples of how you, so book appointments, we heard that. How else will AI interact directly with people in a way that could be a pretense or could fool a gullible person?
Well, if you think of robocallers, nobody's favorite thing, they're gated in part, there's some laws, but in part because you have to have a person on the phone and that costs money. Imagine if you have an army of true robocallers who would call you and would be effective because you think you're talking to a person. And they could do debt collection. They could ask you for information. They could even be inside Barbie. And in Barbie these days, there's Barbie models that are shipped with a chip inside, which effectively means that Barbie could be talking to your kid and eliciting all kinds of information and sending it upstream. We know that the companies like Google and Facebook, who do ad targeting, others as well, are very hungry for our information to do better ad targeting. Well, what a better way to do that than to elicit the information by somebody who sounds like you and me?
I have Ken's personal information. Why not give me your dad?
You know, I ran into this on email. We're talking about voice interactions here, which are a little bit trickier, but there are companies, including one called X.AI, that have these bots, essentially, that will serve as your personal assistant to schedule appointments on email. So they might say, hey, Todd, Oren wants to schedule an appointment to meet up at your office. And what times do you have available? And so you're interacting. And in my case, it was unknowing to me. It took me a while to figure out that this person that I was scheduling an appointment with was actually a bot. So I think the disclosure there is actually, it's an important issue. In hindsight, I would have preferred to have known, hey, I'm not dealing with a real human here, because then I might dispense with some of the things that I would otherwise do. It would make me foolish if I was asking that artificial intelligent assistant about, you know, their kids or something, you know, the chit chat you might do on email.
Will Congress or the Washington State Legislature, et cetera, propose mandatory bot labeling? And would there be anything controversial about that? Who would say no, no mandatory disclosure?
Well, whenever you have labeling, you have a cost, right? I am amazed, right? I see in my food, there's GMO labeling. Cigarette labeling was very controversial. So there's a cost. And there's also, we can start getting overwhelmed with labels, so we stop paying attention to them, like the fine print on a website, right? Who even looks at that? You just click and move on. So I don't think it's something to just, let's just label everything. But I do think it's an important topic to think about.
You know, if you don't have to disclose artificial intelligence, I might learn to not trust anything. But if I think I can depend on labeling, then won't I fall prey to the dishonest AI users who take advantage of that?
There's definitely going to be dishonesty, right? Any rules we set up would only be at least initially local to the United States. And so on the internet, right, nobody knows you're a dog. So very much buyer beware, and you have to be careful anyway. The thing I'd like to point out, though, is that we're painting this with a very negative brush. But of course, this technology has some very positive uses as well, right? These technologies are not evil. So I was thinking of somebody who is challenged in hearing or challenged in speaking, how painful it could be for them to make an appointment. Some of these things that we take for granted. Now, if they had a bot working for them, make it a lot easier for them to just manage these everyday interactions.
How much, though, can you rely on a bot at this point? That is my struggle when I think about things like handing over the email scheduling to a personal assistant, like I was saying before. I have a hard time handing that over to a human, let alone an artificial intelligence entity.
You want to drive.
Yeah, exactly. And I think a lot of us have that need for control. Have you seen the level of AI competence at this point that would justify even turning it over, let alone being, you know, able to sort of allow them to run with it?
Well, I think two things. First of all, the question is always compared to what, right? So if you are one of the few people who can work with a human assistant, humans are still far superior. If you don't have that luxury, that's a different story. That's number one. Number two, this technology moves very fast. So once we see this, our experience has been that they start to collect more data and more data, and very rapidly these things improve. So that's why I call it a canary in the coal mine. Very soon, and by very soon I mean within a year or two, we're going to see a wide range of systems that in these narrow targeted scenario, booking an appointment, ordering flowers, they're going to do it automatically using voice and quite seamlessly.
Wait a second. I'm just realizing, you know, we've scheduled appointments before. Has that been a real assistant that you were referring me to or an AI agent?
No comment.
Wow. You know, you say humans are far superior, but I often choose the supermarket scanner, the gas station pay at the pump. I mean, if we're given the choice, maybe sometimes we would choose to talk to a bot.
More efficient, right?
We see that with stores like Amazon Go, right? Some people not only are fascinated, but actually like it. I've definitely been in situations where I'm waiting in line, right, at the cashier, and I wish I had another choice, particularly if it was an efficient one, right? I actually fumble with these scanners. I just want to do the Amazon Go thing of pick up the stuff and just walk off and be billed appropriately.
Well, you mentioned an upside to AI that could deal with a human, someone who has trouble hearing or talking, making those kinds of appointments. What are worst case scenarios of course, I want to protect my identity, my money, I guess, but like, what's the bad that could happen from these bots being so good that they could fool a human, as we heard?
I can imagine very bad things. So let's talk about politics. We already saw in the previous election the effect of bots in swaying public opinion and potentially the outcome of the election.
Would that be labeled the Russian Twitter bot or a fake Facebook post? Would that have to be mandatory labeled?
Well, one thing we could do is build technologies that attempt to detect those and give them a little screening test. So one thing about these programs is they don't have an iota of common sense. So what if, like, we have CAPTCHAs today that require you to write down some digits? We'd ask the bot a simple question like, how many fingers does a hand have? Or, you know, completely unanticipated question, what's the color of the sky? So if we ask it a set of questions, we'd quickly see that it's a bot, and then we could at least label it as a suspected bot.
Those sound like easy questions.
Well, they're easy for humans and actually very hard for machines. It's one of these amazing paradoxes, right? We can build AI programs that can play Go better than the world champion, but they can't do some of the very basic things that even a seven-year-old can do.
That said, I was so struck by the level of competence of that Google Duplex bot in the phone call. They had other examples where somebody threw different options and somebody misspoke and then, you know, re-explained which days of the week the store was open, and the bot went right along with it. Now, how many of the bad conversations?
We didn't hear the failures.
Exactly. That said, it was reaching the point where if you look at a CAPTCHA, you start to wonder, could these bots actually handle these kinds of tests that would usually require human judgment? It seems that to the casual observer like me, like, it's getting to the point where it could be possible for the robots to take over, is basically what I'm saying, Oren.
Well, let's not get carried away, Todd. What I agree with you with is that they have or will soon have a very versatile appointment scheduler. But if you go off topic, if you say, hang on, I'm not sure if you're human, would you mind answering the following two questions for me? Just a couple of quick questions off topic, because they could be about anything. They could be about cats. They could be about Twitter. They could be about math. Hey, by the way, what's 3 + 5? If it's not set up to answer that, it'll get stuck.
Okay, so you're not concerned when it comes to a human being fooled by a robot. Your mind doesn't go to, cataclysm, you know, terrorist attack, you know, faked. Wait a minute. Was that world leader just saying, I have just pushed the button? I mean, you're not worried about things getting worse as far as who, wait a minute, what is truth anymore?
No, I am worried about that. I'm not worried about robots taking over, but the potential, that's actually where I was trying to go with the Twitter bots example. We saw that in the elections, but the next step, and we're already seeing some of that, right? But it's being done manually. The next step is automatically produce content, images, videos, statements, right? And we have this, what's called deep fakes, using deep learning of, you know, Obama saying things that he didn't say.
Yes, we played some of that. Jordan Peele poses as Obama. At the University of Washington did that Obama saying something he didn't say test.
Right, right. So that's extremely, extremely dangerous. We have to ask ourselves, is this really, you know, the president of the United States? How can we be sure?
I think this is also one area where the Seattle region is poised to lead, not only in the development of artificial intelligence, as you see here with Oren and the Allen Institute.
I should restate, yeah, Oren is the CEO of the Allen Institute for Artificial Intelligence. Yes, based here in Seattle.
The University of Washington, where Oren is also a professor. Microsoft, they are really doubling down on AI across the company, and one of their big areas of focus is ethics, the ethics of AI, researchers including Eric Horvitz over there. So I think this is an example where we can actually apply some Pacific Northwest values to this. It's funny, with Google making this big splashy tech demo last week, the reporters had to follow up with them and talk about ethics, whereas at Microsoft's Build conference, it was one of the key topics. You know, and you could debate whose AI is better or worse, but it was interesting that on the agenda for Microsoft was ethics, and I think that's important.
You think Microsoft has a different and more Pacific Northwest approach to these ethical bot question?
It may be a little more complex than that. I think Microsoft learned a lot of the lessons of the 80s and the 90s and the battles with the Federal Trade Commission over all their problems that they had with privacy and everything like that, and antitrust with the Justice Department. So I think Microsoft may just be a little more mature in that way. That said, I think from a competitive standpoint for the region, it's a good thing to focus on ethics, because clearly it's something that matters to the everyday person out there.
Oren, any last messages you want us to know as we're listening to a robot make a hair salon appointment and considering where is this heading? What do you want to tell us?
I want to say two things. One is the landscape is changing fast. So if you want to be up on the latest and greatest, you know, learn to code, learn what's going on, you know, understand this. There's no stopping it, number one. And number two, I would encourage people at both extremes to be a little bit cautious. So people who are thinking, you know, gloom and doom, right? Reality is coming to an end because we won't know what's what. No, we'll figure this out as we have before. And the people on the other hand who see AI as a panacea, hey, progress is always good. No, let's be thoughtful about this and understand how we can make it good by putting the right guardrails in place.
Speaking of what's reality, how long will it be until we're talking about a telephone call right now, so far? How long until we can't trust in-person interactions, because that's actually a hologram? Or, you know, where's that headed?
I'm not sure about that, but I can tell you that the one thing that's already happening is, you know, this celebrity pornography where celebrity faces are superimposed on performers' bodies. And I was testifying in Congress the other day, and I said, what's this country come to if we can't trust the integrity of our pornography? You could have heard a pin drop in Congress when I said that. It was meant as an innocent joke, but
Congress is an irony-free zone. I don't know if that's going to play.
Yeah, well, this is clearly something that impacts every facet of life, and I think that's just one other example.
Todd Bishop, co-founder of the Seattle-based tech news website GeekWire, and UW computer science professor, CEO of the Allen Institute for Artificial Intelligence in Seattle, Dr. Oren Etzioni. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
It's The Record on KUOW, back in just a moment. KUOW's Region of Boom reporting team has been following the effects of growth down this region's first highway, Highway 99, Aurora Avenue. And this week, they're in Tukwila, just north of SeaTac Airport. Like other parts of 99, the highway through Tukwila was looking old and ragged a few years ago, but it's starting to turn around, thanks in part to something the city did that nobody had ever done before. KUOW's Joshua McNichols explains.
It started with street trees. Tukwila wanted to plant some street trees along the highway to slow down traffic and beautify the area. But the state said no. Trees, it turned out, were not safe. Not as safe as lampposts. Pam Carter was a Tukwila City Council member at the time.
Poles like the light poles are made to break when a car hits them. They fall over. And trees don't.
They wouldn't have let you plant trees on a state highway?
No, because it's supposed to be a highway, and cars, if they ran off the highway, they'd run into these trees and might get hurt.
Trees are considerably less dangerous if you don't hit them very hard. That is, if you're driving slowly. But Carter says the state also rejected Tukwila's request to lower the speed limit.
Traffic was, 50 miles an hour along here, and that made it unpleasant for pedestrians.
It's not that the state wouldn't listen at all to Tukwila's concerns. It's just that they had this process you had to go through, and Tukwila was impatient for change. Then somebody at the city came up with a dramatic idea. Tukwila could steal part of 99 from the state.
I remember them coming to the council with this idea, and all of us going, really? We could do that? How?
Okay, it's not really fair to call it stealing. I mean, first, Tukwila tried asking nicely, but officials at the Washington State Transportation Department said no, State Route 99 was too important to break into pieces. So, Tukwila went over their heads and appealed to their state representative in Olympia, Zach Hudgens.
So I was a newly elected official. This is going back a number of years now.
It was 2003, and Hudgens was eager to please his new constituents.
And the city of Tukwila said, will you help us out with this issue? And they said, we'd like to take over this piece of road. And I said, that seems strange, but okay, I'll give it a try.
His try succeeded. The legislation passed unanimously, and a 2.5-mile segment of Highway 99 now belonged to Tukwila, along with the associated maintenance costs.
When it passed, do you remember how you felt?
Very surprised that it was actually successful.
Tukwila swooped in with shovels and street trees. A Buddhist group donated some.
And they were not put in until after we took ownership of this roadway.
Next, they brought down the speed limit a little and put in some crossing signals. Now it's called Tukwila International Boulevard, and it has wide sidewalks and buried power lines.
We control this. We can decide. And we're talking now about...
In the future, Tukwila might cut down the number of highway lanes to make space for bike lanes and parallel parking. Zach Hudgens is happy with what Tukwila has done with the road.
There's starting to be a real change.
But he's had second thoughts about how it all went down.
Maybe we should have figured out a win-win solution instead of simply giving the road to Tukwila. Communities change, mayors change, councils change, and the road will still have to be there.
Being in government a while has taught him what the state may have been trying to protect when it first fought Tukwila's takeover.
It makes it very difficult to put together a statewide highway system if you're pulling pieces out of it.
But Hudgens says just the threat that other cities might do what Tukwila did helps keep the state accountable. The state's highways belong to the people of Washington. And if the people get impatient, they might just steal their roads back. In Tukwila, I'm Joshua McNichols, KUOW News.
It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. We're live tweeting the show at KUOW. Well, the sun came out for Mother's Day, 85 degrees in Seattle, so maybe you didn't spend the weekend glued to KUOW and the news on your phone. So here's some of what you missed with a little Weekend in Review panel. Wilfred Padua, Seattle-based comedian and food writer Angela Garbez, her new book, not about food, it's about pregnancy, so Mother's Day might come up again. Welcome to the both of you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. The most read story this weekend in the New York Times was an op-ed by a University of Virginia professor called "Liberals, You're Not as Smart as You Think." Politics professor Gerard Alexander says liberals have cultural power, they snidely dismiss conservatives, and, quote, "a backlash against liberals is going to get President Trump reelected." Wilfred, what'd you think of that argument?
I unfortunately agreed with the article a lot more than I wanted to. As someone who is a liberal and someone who's clearly grown up in Seattle, I've become much more critical of liberals because that's my environment. One of the more interesting parts of the article to me was when he was mentioning the rapid growth in society and how there's a lot of like anti-racist growth that's come up and anti-bigotry that's come up. But I think people are forgetting that as that growth occurs, we forget that some people aren't growing as fast and people become condescending and so on and so forth through that. And we forget to empathize with the people that don't have as much knowledge as a liberal would.
Condescending, not empathetic. Angela, you identify as left of liberal. Would you, do you snidely dismiss conservatives?
I try to not snidely dismiss anyone, try to hear them out. But I agree with Wilfred in that I found myself sort of cringing and weirdly agreeing with some aspects of the argument. I mean, I think if I felt that Alexander's argument was genuinely to win people over, I could say it would be easier to endorse what he's saying. But, you know, he had a line that said something like self-righteousness is rarely rewarded and it's rarely attractive. And I mean, he could have applied that to what he was writing because the whole thing dripped with condescension and was really a turnoff. So I don't think you're going to convince anyone, liberals or left of liberals or people who are critical of liberals, to come around to your point of view.
But I don't know this professor, but you're both admitting here you're in the Seattle bubble and you're saying, yeah, liberals can we're overdoing it. Let me give some examples for people who haven't read the op-ed. Just some examples that the professor threw out is that college campuses ought to let right-wingers speak and then discuss where they disagree instead of keeping them off campus. He brought up microaggressions, suggesting basically that most white people don't believe they're being aggressive and they resent the charge. He brought up President Obama's Rust Belt voters get bitter and cling to guns or religion. Are those examples in your mind of liberal elitist overreach?
Well, one of the things for me as in conversations about racism and whatnot and like trying to create a more open-minded, I guess, liberal world, conversation is the most important thing to me, as opposed to like telling someone they can't come to this college campus or telling someone that they shouldn't say a certain term. I'd rather have the mistake happen and then have the conversation about the mistake rather than just say, hey, that was you're a racist, and then stop conversation at that once that statement is made.
There's a couple I want to ask you what you think of that, Angela. There's a couple different ways that you mentioned college campuses disinviting or not inviting basically right wingers. There's also the quote unquote shouting down, the call out culture, all that's happening. What do you think of the idea that liberals are not being open to discourse, Angela?
Well, I think, you know, we should open up the discourse within the liberal, quote unquote, liberal community, right? So, what am I trying to say here? I mean, I think who's doing the calling out? Who are these liberals that we're talking about? Are we talking about rich white liberals who, like all wealthy people, whatever your political thing is, you tend to feel entitled to power, so you feel like you can control that conversation? So I'd say even within liberal communities, there are people who are being quieted down to give voice to people who have a little more privilege as liberal people. So I think, you know, the things that they're trying to call out, racism, bigotry, those are things very, very worthy of being called out. But I think a lot of liberals could also look in the mirror and see themselves in that, you know, because we live in a racist country. That's just a fact. So everyone has some looking to do, some asking questions of themselves. And I think that there could be a conversation within the liberal community about that.
On our Facebook page, a listener named Paul writes, "Until conservatives can have a debate without calling someone libtard or snowflake, I don't see why liberals should be the ones required to moderate the discourse." That's a line of argument. You could also say, as the Obamas did, when they go low, you go high. And if conservatives are so bad, doesn't that mean liberals are exactly the ones who need to moderate the discourse?
I think that if liberals are going to think that we are the ones with the right answers, we need to figure out how to teach those answers to the people that aren't ready to hear it. Like, and through that is conversation and understanding from where they're coming from.
Yeah.
Yes. I want to hit a couple other topics that came up this week. And one was gambling, because this morning, actually, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down a law that kept states from authorizing sports gambling. The challenge was brought by New Jersey. Here in Washington, our gambling laws are some of the nation's toughest. Fantasy sports companies have said they're prohibited from operating here. Angela, you're a big sports fan. So if DraftKings or a FanDuel, if you could bet on fantasy sports, would you love it?
I'm risk averse. So okay. While I love watching sports and could spend every evening doing it, I'm not prone to gambling.
Would your sports watching be diminished if you knew that people were betting? What's your favorite sport? What do we think? In Seattle, you're rooting for the what?
I'm an NBA basketball fan, which
Uh-oh.
Is a tragedy.
Wow, sorry.
Living here in Seattle. So, I mean, here's the thing. I personally don't gamble, but I know many people who do. And that's casually on individual games, sometimes larger sums than they maybe should be. And people who I know are avid fantasy players who would probably put money on it if they could. Mm. So, I mean, we have these strict rules, but, you know, this kind of ruling perhaps brings some friends of mine out of the shadows.
Into the light.
Yeah.
I don't gamble, and I don't think that would hurt my experience as a viewer of professional sports. I think it would actually enhance it because I'm not going to roll the dice with my money. But if my friend has money on, like, the Celtics, I'll care about the Celtics.
The stakes are higher.
Yeah.
I mean, there's part of me that's suspicious. I think if we legalize gambling, that really there's a corporation or there's an institution that's going to benefit from this, that's
for sure.
Just taking money, taking advantage of human weakness and lining their pockets with money. But at the same time, I suppose, bringing people into the light and exposing that this is an activity that people are engaging in, whether it's legal or not, it's happening.
Well, there was the famous example of the Chicago, they called them the Black Sox. This is the Chicago White Sox throwing the World Series. I swear, that must have been 100 years ago. But I was fascinated by that when I was a kid, when mm-hmm. I found out that what? Major leaguers threw the game? And there's something, some people are worried that sports, A, has integrity, B, could lose integrity if people are putting money on the game. You know, then it's just that much easier for insiders, coaches, players to be putting money on the game.
I know that like NBA viewership is down from how it used to be, and I think maybe losing integrity in the NBA might make it more entertaining.
Interesting.
Yeah, because I think like I miss the old days when like Gary Payton used to talk trash to Michael Jordan, mm-hmm. and like where people weren't such professional sports professional athletes. I kind of want more personality. I would love to see a much more flawed character.
I mean, I think sports fans like myself have had to make peace. You know, integrity, sports is not setting the high bar of integrity. You know, like from college, we exploit young athletes from a young age, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the NFL makes money off of people getting severe brain damage, right? You've already made peace. Like the integrity argument is a little less compelling to me.
Finally on that, do you want Washington State to be just as sports bet friendly as New Jersey, Nevada? Is there something you like about being different out here? I mean, we're just less of a gambling state, although we have a lottery.
Well, I mean, I think it's cool that Jay Inslee doesn't have the same priorities as Chris Christie. So mm-hmm. I'm cool with Washington forging its own path, re gambling laws.
I could not be less invested in this.
Finally, yesterday was Mother's Day, which some people apparently don't like. There is a somewhat of a movement online to rethink Mother's Day. Angela, would you recap the issue and tell me whether you have that issue with Mother's Day?
Sure. I mean, I have complicated feelings about Mother's Day. As a mother myself, my feeling is give me a year of paid family leave instead of giving me flowers one day out of the year.
You know, you think Mother's Day is a kind of excuse for not giving mothers more?
I mean, I think it's a way that it's like a Band-Aid that we try to put on a gaping wound, right? So
Happy Mother's Day.
Happy Mother's Day. But I think, you know, we could definitely support mothers more day to day. That's my point about that. But I think, you know, there's a movement or at least a conversation among mothers and people who pay attention to this issue and who think about it a lot, that people have complicated relationships both to their own mothers and to being a mother. So it's not so much let's get rid of Mother's Day. The movement that I enjoy tracking or that I am on board with is to expand it instead of saying Mother's Day, which ties things to one person, one entity, one gender, to celebrating Mothering Day. So you make it a verb. It doesn't exclude mothers, but it acknowledges that no one makes it through infancy or childhood without being nourished and mothered by someone. And that can include people who are not, you know, the gestational biological parent. That can include people who are not female. That it's people who helped raise.
What about people being fathered?
Well, you
I mean,
have
you know,
a day.
We do a little child care.
You
FYI.
Have a day, yeah. And you also have a patriarchal culture. So
I see. Anyway, yeah, what do you think about Mother's Day and rethinking it, Wilfred?
I think Angela has a good point. Where maybe rethinking it to be more open. I wasn't too in tuned with this quote unquote movement that's been happening. I think movement is probably a
movement might be a little strong.
Yes. But I think that I don't think anyone is offended that I'm celebrating my mom. Or anyone is trying to stop me from celebrating my mom on one day. I mean, I give her Mother's Day because I'm not the best every other day of the year. So I go really hard.
It really does matter to a lot of people. Mother's Day is important. No one's saying that we shouldn't celebrate.
Yes, and
Mother's
Day.
Your mom deserves props.
My mom definitely deserves props, and Mother's Day is important to her. So I give her that day, and I go pretty hard on Mother's Day. And
how so? Give me one example of going hard on Mother's Day.
I drove to Kent. I mean, that was...
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
You're in.
Yeah. Drove to Kent and bought food. Oh, that was a lot. So
I could do without schools pushing Mother's Day, because we got that. Like my kid, and I love our school, I love the teachers, I love the staff, but my kids bring home a Mother's Day project. I did that when I was a kid.
Yeah.
You know, we keep saying teachers are overburdened. We can take Mother's Day off the school's plate. I got it. We can handle that here.
Sometimes, I've worked in Seattle Public Schools for years, and sometimes I think that helps narrow things down for teachers with like how to get the... It's a seasonal project, and it's a thing that they can do recurringly, and it
so I see. So it's an excuse. You're teaching them how to do a project, meet the deadline. There's a deadline
sure.
coming. Okay,
yeah.
Fair enough. Everybody was happy with their Mother's Day project. Angela, you have a new book just about to come out.
Yes.
Speaking of Mother's Day, but your book is about the science and culture of pregnancy.
Yes.
What? Tell us about that, would you?
Well, one of the last times I was here talking about an article that I wrote about miscarriage. Mm-hmm. We had a good conversation about that.
Yep.
And so the book is, that piece is included in that, an expanded version of it. But basically, I just feel like the way we have framed pregnancy and motherhood is we always present things in a very moral framework. Do this, don't do that. There's a right way to do things. There's a wrong way to do things. And all the books you read as a pregnant person set you up to think about things that way. And I just didn't think that was necessarily how we needed to look at things. I wanted information straight so that I could make my own decisions. So that's kind of the starting point for the book. And I had a long list of questions, from miscarriage to breast milk to, you know, can I drink wine? Why is that supposedly bad? And, you know, why do we think of childbirth as being only natural or medicated? So I really just dove deep into a lot of emerging science, which is out there, but not necessarily reaching pregnant people. And
but don't some of us want to be told what's the right thing to do? You know, I want to form the brain, and I want to do everything right.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, I understand the desire for that, but it's just inherently more complex and nuanced like that. Mm-hmm. And people can still follow whatever advice they want, but there are a lot of people like myself who want to think critically through pregnancy and can handle complexity and nuance, and we should have the opportunity to do that. And I wanted to create a resource for people like me and my friends.
Angela Garbez, the book's coming out real soon.
May 29th.
Called?
Like a Mother, A Feminist Journey Through the Science and Culture of Pregnancy.
Angela Garbez, thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Wilfred Padua, when are you on stage in Seattle?
Oh, I'm on stage every day that I can be. The next...
Wilfred's a comedian.
Yes, I'm a comedian. I don't know if that's been reflected in this...
I that's a good thing. I've been a comedian. We have other thoughts in our brains.
May 24th, Egan's Ballard Jam House. I'll be doing a show there at 9 p.m. Otherwise, I would just say follow me on Twitter and Instagram because that's where I do all my updating of my calendar.
Wilfred Padua, thanks.
Thank you.
And thank you for tuning in to The Record on KUOW. Produced by Amina Alsadi, Allison Bruzek, Ajua Jimma Brempong, Jason Pagano, social media producer Bree Ripley. Tomorrow, what if the Seahawks had run from the one and this never happened?
Oh my God, it's picked off at the goal line!
We'll answer the question. Slate's Mike Pesca's new book is, upon further review, the greatest what-ifs in sports history. That's tomorrow.